Yeah. Shy. Really get your nose right in there, really. A little citrus. Maybe some strawberry. Passion fruit. And, oh, there's just like the faintest sousson of like asparagus, and there's a just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Wow.
Strawberries, yeah.
Good.
Strawberries.
Yeah.
Not the cheese.
Okay, that's from the movie Sideways. We're going to talk about rosé. It's having its day as a refreshing summer libation. But is it actually a good wine? And how can you tell? We're going to talk to a sommelier about how bad rosé is taking over the market. That's coming up a little later in the show. First, though, an update on immigration news. Late yesterday, a federal judge here in California ruled that the Trump administration cannot deport reunited families. More than 2,500 migrant families were separated under his zero tolerance policy when they were caught at the border between April and June. Parents had to make a tough choice. Either agree to be deported alone and let your child go through the asylum process here in the United States, or waive your child's right to seek asylum, stay together, and be deported together. Well, now Judge Dana Sabra has put a temporary stop to that. And for more, we have Dara Lynn. She's immigration reporter at Vox. Hi, Dara.
Hi, good to be on.
Great to have you back. Well, where does this ruling put migrant families now? They are still in detention together, right? And so how long will they be able to remain together in the United States?
This ruling, even though it's only temporary, there's no particular end date on it. It's basically something that Judge Sabra has done in the past, which is he's putting together a temporary ruling and then telling each side in this lawsuit, you guys now work out a plan from here. So he's saying that because he doesn't feel that the asylum rights of the child were being respected by forcing parents to quote-unquote waive their asylum rights for on their children's behalf, that deporting parents summarily with their children is not going to fly. But who exactly gets to go through the asylum process and what process they do get to go through is still kind of up in the air. So for the families who are still in detention and those who have been released but where the parent is subject to deportation whenever the government says, those two categories together account for about 1,000 families, they're still kind of in limbo. A lot of families who are in detention have been getting really desperate, have been, you know, threatening hunger strikes and actually engaging in some disobedience because they just don't know what's going to happen to them. And so even though this protects the rights of children and is a great thing for families that had tried to allow their children to stay in the U.S. and they claim were kind of coerced into waiving those rights, there are also cases where families are just feeling very much, you know, stuck and in the dark, and that this doesn't necessarily address their concerns.
Well, could the government release them with an ankle monitor or whatever and have them come back for a later court date?
Yes, absolutely, and they have done that in some cases, but they're not forced to. Judge Sabra made it very clear in a ruling earlier this week that he does think the government has the right to force parents to choose either to be detained with their kids or to allow their kids to be released without them. The government can't be forced to just release the whole family together. So even though that's not a choice they can force parents to make about deportation, they can choose force them to choose that for detention. So we may see more of that in the coming weeks.
And meanwhile, are families still coming across the border?
It's a typical pattern to see a real reduction in apprehensions at the border in July and August. And we definitely did see that in July. We don't have the August numbers yet. Of course, the Trump administration took credit for that, saying that that was the result of the, you know, harsh policies that they had implemented in the months prior to that. This year's pattern is not inconsistent with what we generally see, which is that people just don't come across when it's really hot.
Right.
So we're not, it's not yet clear, you know, what, if any, effect in the long term this has had on apprehensions. But it's important to note that every indication we have on kind of cracking down on people once they arrive in the U.S. hasn't changed the, especially families from Central America coming in, because they've made the informed decision in many cases that whatever is going to happen to them in the States has the potential to be better than what they're experiencing where they are.
Can you talk a little bit about what Judge Sabra actually said and wrote from the bench? Because he's been pretty strict and pretty staunch in his criticism of the government.
Judge Subraw has been very, very focused on the fact that the government did not have the right to separate families and that it is incumbent on them to do everything they can to reunite families. And so in this particular case, even though it's technically a different lawsuit than the one under which he initially ordered families to be reunited, he rejected the argument the government had made that it was okay for them to, you know, make parents withdraw their children's asylum claims. He made it very clear that, you know, he had told them that they were supposed to reunify parents with their children regardless, and they turned around and implied to parents that they would be reunited if they withdrew their child's claims. So he's been pretty firm and is kind of increasingly frustrated with the government's lack of initiative. One of the other questions that's going to come up in a hearing later this afternoon is the question of what's going to happen to parents who have been deported. The government's, you know, opinion on that has been that that should be the job of non-governmental organizations. Judge Subraw has been pretty clear that he doesn't think that's a responsible attitude for them to take, that they really need to understand the consequences of having separated families and at least be willing to fix the damage that they've done already.
You mean in terms of reuniting those families where the adult has already been deported?
Yeah, and there is kind of a second order of conversation here about, does the government have the obligation to treat a reunited family with the same leniency it would have treated a family that was never separated? That's something that I think it's going to take months or longer probably to work out.
So meanwhile, how many are still in detention?
I don't believe we have tremendously perfect numbers on that, but of the 2,000 that have been reunified, about 1,000 could be deported at any given time. Not all of those are in detention. Some of them have been released, but those are the ones who are really affected by this latest order because now they're still ordered deported, but it's not clear when that deportation order is going to be acted upon.
All right, Dara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dara Lind, she's an immigration reporter at Fox. Coming up, why Jeff and Beau Bridges pay relatively little in taxes on their Malibu beachfront property. An old law lets people who inherit homes keep their taxes low. That's next on Press Play. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Hey, do you want to rent a Malibu beach house? Well, I have one for you. It's going to cost $16,000 a month, but it is on a semi-private beach, and your landlords would be Jeff and Beau Bridges, the famous actor brothers. That is a real rental that was advertised earlier this year. Jeff and Beau Bridges probably don't need the money, but it is a great deal for them. And that's because they inherited that house from their mom, and the property taxes are super low. That's because of a special California law that lets people inherit old tax breaks with property. California is the only state that has that law. An investigation in the Los Angeles Times today looks at how some of the state's wealthiest families are reaping the benefits of that at the expense of school districts, cities, and counties, which could use the tax income. Liam Dillon covers state politics and housing policy for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so you found a lot of examples of people like the Bridges. They're already wealthy, they're pretty prominent, and they benefit from this inheritance tax break on income property. What is this inheritance tax break?
Right. So in 1978, so 40 years ago, California's passed Proposition 13, which restricted property tax increases on homes. And what happened 8 years later is that voters said, this is great. We want our kids to have the same benefit. And so what happens is when someone inherits their parents' homes, they also inherit the low property tax bills that their parents also got.
Because normally if a home is sold, the assessed value bumps up to the current value and the taxes are reassessed based on the current value, right?
Exactly. If I'm buying a house and I'm paying taxes on my purchase price, and so this transfer from parent to child does not treat that like a property sale. Instead, it treats it like nothing ever happened.
So what was the motivation behind that? Why did that come into being?
Yeah, so the author who spoke to us for this story, this edition of Prop 13 passed in 1986. He said a couple things. First, we like families, and we want to do something that benefits them. And so, we don't want families to be taxed out of the of their parents' homes, or kids to be taxed out of their parents' homes. And also, he said, look, you know, corporations, they get to kind of keep their same ownership and keep their low property tax rates forever, and so we should give that to families too.
But like I said, California is the only state that has that, and surely other families inherit houses in other states, and then they have to pay the current taxes, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. And, you know, certainly California's property tax system as a whole is unique, but this is sort of an extra benefit to the extent that, you know, a lot of folks who have looked at this, including U.S. Supreme Court justices, have kind of criticized this practice as really being something more like you would see in the medieval feudal times, where you have landowners getting, you know, preferential treatment, tax treatment or land treatment from the government that non-landowners don't get.
And you found that this is primarily happening in wealthy enclaves?
Yeah, so we looked at the 13 counties along the coast where California's housing problems are the deepest and prices are the highest, and we found a concentration of these properties in wealthy enclaves in L.A., you know, Malibu, the Palisades, Beverly Hills, Manhattan Beach. A lot of those places had a much higher concentration of these properties being inherited by children than other places in the state.
And the issue is, originally it was to protect children from being thrown out, right, that this would be their primary residence. But you found that most of these residences are either vacation homes or rental properties. They don't even live there.
Exactly. Yes. They're turning their parents' homes into windfalls or investments. So we found in L.A. County, as many as 63% of the homes that have been inherited under the system over the past year are being used as rentals or second residences.
So is there anyone saying, OK, we got to change this?
Yeah, there are some, you know, some folks along the lines of those who feel like Prop 13 in general is a bad policy and should be changed. So those kinds of folks. Additionally, you have the California Association of Realtors, which is a powerful interest group around the state, you know, floating this idea to get rid of the inheritance a tax break for investment property. But they only really want to do that as part of a larger measure that would also expand other tax breaks under Prop 13.
And how much tax revenue are cities and counties and schools losing because of this?
Yeah, so we did a detailed analysis in L.A. County, and we found last year schools, cities, and the county government itself lost $280 million. There was a study done by the legislative analyst on a statewide basis recently, and they found an annual loss of $1.5 billion. You know, across the state. And it's important to keep in mind, you know, every year that goes by, more properties are inherited, therefore the tax loss is larger.
Right. So I guess also this law has been used to its intended effect, right? It is actually helping people who aren't really rich and famous stay in their houses, their childhood homes, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, certainly. I mean, if 63% are being used as rentals, that means, a smaller percentage, but certainly a meaningful percentage are not. And people are living in their parents' homes and have access to this property with a tax break they otherwise wouldn't have gotten. That being said, this only benefits homeowners. So if your parents in California were renters, you don't get these same advantages that a child of a homeowner does.
Right. So this law definitely benefits people who are already well off, or at least comfortably off.
Yeah. And there's a lot of studies that show that, children of homeowners in general are wealthier or more well off. Certainly when you inherit property, it's more likely that property, their mortgage has been paid off and things like that. So you can tap home equity loans. And so, yes, in general, those who are wealthier are getting a benefit compared to those who are not as well off.
And how could this possibly be kind of inflating housing prices? Would this go into, because there's been the argument that Prop 13 inflates housing prices because it makes for a less fluid market. People are less likely to sell their homes, and so there's less inventory available, and therefore housing prices are higher. Would this also do the same thing?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, if I'm inheriting my parents' house that my parents owned free and clear, and then I'm paying super low taxes on it, you know, and then I can make a ton of money renting it out, why would I sell it?
Right. So, again, it's taking supply off the market, driving up housing prices.
Indeed, yeah, and also benefiting, you know, the bank accounts of children of whose parents were smart enough or lucky enough, whatever, to buy houses in the 70s.
Okay, lucky Bridges, lucky Beau and Jeff.
Yeah.
Liam Dillon covers state politics and housing policy for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to rosé all
day. Rosé all day. Rosé. Well, they may not be paying much in property taxes, but the rosé has probably been flowing at that Malibu beachfront this summer. Rosé is just everywhere at summer dinner parties. But there is a dark side to rosé. Some of it is just plain bad. Here to explain is Victoria James. She's a sommelier and author of the book Drink Pink, A Celebration of Rosé. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Okay, first of all, what is a rosé? Is it just a mix of red and white grapes?
Well, that's one of the ways of making rosé. But if you do that in France, especially, you can't legally call it rosé. In fact, rosé is made from typically red grapes. They just don't spend as much time in contact with the skins, so it picks up a little bit of color instead of a lot of bit of color, which is the case in red wine.
All right. Now, you just wrote an article in Bon Appetit magazine about how this bad rosé is taking over. What is bad rosé?
Bad rosé, in my opinion, is rosé that is bulk wine that is masquerading as something that it's not. You know, in these funny bottle shapes, or there's these huge marketing campaigns or money behind it. But to me, rosé is a wine first and foremost, and it should speak of a place. It should be high quality. It shouldn't just be made from rotten grapes, low quality grapes, underripe fruit, or as a byproduct from red wine.
And that's what bulk wine is?
Some of it, yes. And this is huge in, you know, large swaths of land in California, as well as southern France and Provence. It's sort of these, you know, factory-made wines, and they're not delicious to drink.
Hmm. So you're sommelier at Côte in New York. So you, I'm sure, get pitched all the time from these companies, these wine companies, and they're trying to get you to stock their rosé. So are they also trying to get you to stock really bad rosé that they're trying to convince you is good rosé?
Yeah. So, you know, as a buyer, I get hundreds of emails every single day, people trying to sell me their products. Some are great and some are not. You know, and if it isn't necessarily the highest quality, they try and take other angles, such as marketing or things that span the gray area of what is and isn't legal.
Like what?
So, you know, there's this huge thing in the liquor and wine biz, which stemmed from Prohibition and lasted throughout the 50s, 60s. It was called payola back then. What we call today pay to play. And it can be, for example, a company will pay for printing for your menus. In return, they ask that their wine be listed on the menu, maybe buying a new wine fridge for the restaurant or taking you on free trips or even just direct cash incentives, which are highly illegal.
Hmm.
And the unfortunate thing about this is that the average consumer, such as yourself, you don't see what's going on behind closed doors. So when you go into your wine shop or restaurant, you think that these wines or rosés are on the list or on the shelf because the buyer believes in them. Mm-hmm. What you don't know is that the buyer is actually getting a payday.
Oh, gosh. So you have to go to a buyer that you trust.
Exactly.
How do you know if a rosé is any good when you're looking at the bottle?
You know, it's tricky. You can't. And that's one of the things that, you know, these companies definitely take advantage of. You have no way of knowing just by looking at the bottle. So one of the best tricks I always say is for the consumer to ask their sommelier or shop for grower rosé. And what that means is that the person who grows the grapes makes the wine. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be high quality, but almost always it is. And the reason for that is, you know, for example, Madeline, let's say you were making your own rosé, Madeline Rosé, and you were growing your grapes. Your name's on it. And so as a result, you're usually pretty proud of what's inside and the quality. You can't hide behind a big company. And these are people that can't afford to do pay-to-play. They're small growers, they're farmers, and they're true to their land.
Hmm. So family-run or small growers, that's the way to go.
Well, family-run's tricky because there are a lot of big families that are actually big corporations.
Yeah. So there's like Mondavi, Gallo, right?
I didn't say that, you did.
I'm just saying as an example of a family-run winery.
You know, it's tricky. That's what makes a sommelier job so, so hard. And that's what pisses me off as a sommelier when I see other sommeliers taking these incentives, because it's so hard to figure out what is a good and bad bottle of wine for the consumer. And so they place their trust in us. And for us to take that trust and then take advantage of it is just, it's just horrible. Because there is an influx of very good rosé, too. So it's just unfortunate that these big brands are watering down the whole category.
What is an example of a good California rosé?
Yeah, so a great California rosé, a lot of them that I really love come from slightly cooler climates, so around Santa Barbara and Santa Ynez. There's a great one called A Tribute to Grace, and it's a female winemaker that makes a Grenache-based rosé there, and it's just fabulous. And when you taste it, it tastes like the place and the person behind it. It just tastes honest and delicious, and better yet, it won't break the bank.
A Tribute to Grace.
Yes.
Who's Grace?
Well, the winemaker named the wine after her grandmother, and so Grace is her grandmother.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Also something you don't get in large companies.
Right. So why do you like rosé so much?
When I was going through all of my sommelier exams, in order to become a sommelier and working in restaurants, you have to memorize all of these obscure laws and read tons and tons of books and study and memorize. But there's something about rosé that's inherently celebratory, and there, of course, are some rules that govern it, but it's almost sort of freedom in wine. And that's one of the things I loved about rosé. Even if a lot of producers in France, for example, are governed strictly and they have a lot of rules for their red and white, with their rosé, they can kind of do whatever they want. And I always loved that. And it's one of the most versatile beverages. It goes with everything. And it's just so pleasant to drink year-round. It's affordable. And I really wanted to write the book in order to talk about all of the producers that have inspired me and all of the growers throughout my travels. And it's delicious.
Okay. Well, you've convinced me. And it is August. It's hot. It seems perfect to have some rosé.
I agree.
Victoria James, she's a sommelier at the Côte Korean Steakhouse in New York. Her book is called Drink Pink, A Celebration of Rosé. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, how a small movie about women skateboarders attracted a relatively big name.
We were talking about different skateboarders and actors and everything, and I asked her, I was like, Rochelle, like, what skateboarder acts? She's like, well, I know an actor that skateboards. His name's Jaden Smith.
A conversation with the director of Skate Kitchen next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A few years ago, Crystal Mizell stumbled upon a group of strange-looking siblings on the streets of New York City. She became friends with them and made a documentary about their lives called The Wolf Pack. Well, she met the subjects of her new film in a similar way on the subway. And they're also a tribe, young women who skateboard together. They call themselves the Skate Kitchen. But instead of a documentary, Crystal Mizell made a feature film called Skate Kitchen. And Crystal joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
You met these girls and you saw them on the subway, these young women. And you thought, I have to do something. I have to make some kind of film. Why did you think that and how did you approach them?
Well, for one, they had skateboards in their hands, which was something that was rare to see. At least 2 years ago, it was.
Young women holding skateboards.
Yeah, but now even just in the last 2 years, it's completely changed. So that, and then also Nina has this incredible voice that pulls you towards her. Just very charismatic, and mm-hmm. she's very alive, and you want to know what she's talking about.
She's one of the characters in your movie. Mm-hmm. And so is she playing herself in your movie?
Yeah, they all are pretty much. Uh-huh.
And then you have a real movie star, Jaden Smith.
Yeah.
In there. Just to liven it up a little? No.
Well, Jaden hit up Rochelle on Instagram before the whole film and everything was happening because he had seen her skateboarding on Instagram and he was impressed.
Okay.
So he hit her up and I guess they were talking about skating together at some point.
So she was friends with him?
I mean, only just through a couple conversations on Instagram. But when we were writing the movie, we were just trying to figure out, you know, the narrative and what we were going to do with it. And one of the ideas was like, okay, well, maybe we should like create this kind of love interest that gets in between these girls. And we were talking about different skateboarders and actors and everything. And I asked her, I said, you know, I was like, Rochelle, like, what skateboarder acts? She's like, well, I know an actor that skateboards. His name's Jaden Smith.
You may have heard of him. Will Smith is his dad.
Yeah.
So Rochelle is your lead. She plays Camille. And why did you want her to be the lead? What was it about her story that you thought, okay, I'm going to make a movie about her?
Well, when I first met her, Nina, Rochelle would come into the city and we just started having those conversations about her first time coming into New York. And I think that we just sort of bonded over her really being almost like this fish out of water when she's in New York. And I'd hang out with them and it always felt like she's a little bit disconnected from their group because they're all city girls. And she's, you know, this girl from Long Island, and it was a different world. And she's very creative and we really connected.
And she, in the movie, is rebelling against her mom. Her mom's mm-hmm. a single mom. She's Latina.
Yep.
She doesn't get why Camille skateboards.
Yeah.
And she sees it as something that could maybe be harmful for her later in terms of having kids or whatever. Because at the beginning, she has an accident where she hurts herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that her real story, the actress's, Rochelle's story?
Yeah, Rochelle's mom is from Colombia. And they did have a lot of friction when, you know, she started skateboarding, and it's dangerous and it's hard for a mom to understand.
Yeah.
So we did, you know, pull off of her real experiences in her life.
And in the movie, Camille escapes. She runs away because she can't handle her mom mm-hmm. telling her she can't skateboard anymore.
Yeah.
And she falls in with this group of girls skating on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
And then she experiences this freedom to do what she wants to do.
Yeah, no, she does. And that isn't completely, like, true to her life, but there is a version that's similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I met her, she was kind of in that place where she was wanting to sort of rebel against, like, her upbringing and do her own thing and be on her own and experience life. And, you know, she was having all these little moments happen and she would tell me about them, and then we'd like write them down and put them on a little post-it note and put it up on a board. And I just kept doing that. And so when we were like sat down, like we were like writing the movie, all the material from their actual experiences was there for us to build off of.
I was interviewing someone else about mm-hmm. skateboarding, and he said that a lot of the culture is online, on video, mm-hmm. that he can't really imagine skateboarding culture without the video component.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it's on Instagram.
Uh-huh.
Instagram is a really, I mean, it's like the hub for women to find each other in skateboarding. And that's how the Skate Kitchen has spread their style and like everything that they do.
And why do they call themselves the Skate Kitchen?
Well, Rochelle was looking on YouTube, and there's like, you know, I think she's looking at different female skateboarders on YouTube. And in the comment section, there would be these boys that would comment and say, you know, you belong in the kitchen making a sandwich. And she was like, what are they talking about? And I think she was very young when she saw that, and she would continue to see it and finally realize, I think she asked like somebody about it and saw that it was a cliche, and that I think it really affected her. And she said, well, you know, if, you know, we're supposed to be in the kitchen making a sandwich, like, we're going to be in the kitchen skateboarding.
So hence the skate kitchen.
Yeah.
And so why didn't you make it a documentary?
I think that I've been wanting to go into the narrative space. I just feel like there's a lot of films that are breaking the barriers between fiction, nonfiction, and I think mainly just in my head, I felt like there's these rules of how you have to make a film and how you make a documentary or work with non-actors. And I think there was a moment when I saw that film where I just told myself, if you're going to do exactly what you felt like doing, what would you do? And that's what I did with this film.
Like a skater.
And I love, yes, like a skater. I really, really love to collaborate with people. And when you do a documentary, you have to step back and observe.
Yeah.
And you kind of just have to let life happen. And I just really like to work with people to find an authenticity together.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Crystal Mizell is the director of Skate Kitchen. It is in theaters now. Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so that means it's time for movie reviews. Here to weigh in on the latest is Jacqueline Coley. She is editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Hello.
Hi, glad to be back.
Welcome back. And joining us, a new entrant to our roster of critics, Mark Jordan Ligon, TV writer, film historian, and he co-hosts the podcast Film Freaks Forever. Hi, Mark.
Good to see you.
All right. We're going to jump in because we have a lot of films today. First up, the CIA action thriller Mile 22, starring Mark Wahlberg with John Malkovich and pro wrestling star Ronda Rousey.
I'm only going to outline this one time. 9 pounds of radioactive isotope is missing.
It's enough to make 6 major cities uninhabitable.
He knows exactly where it is.
Stop where you are, sir.
On your knees, get out.
What do you want?
I want out of the country.
He's wanted for espionage.
We're talking about a corrupt low-level cop.
You're sitting here indicates he's not so low-level.
Be careful.
Jacqueline, I feel like I have seen Mark Wahlberg in this exact same film many times.
Yes,
already.
And probably directed by Peter Berg, because they just seem to keep coming back. I mean, this is another one of these like very unabashed action film from like a throwback to days of Die Hard and Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's Peter Berg, Mark Wahlberg. They've kind of like cornered the market for dad cinema. And it tells a story of a CIA operative who's got to get an asset 22 miles in a foreign country. I mean, very flimsy sort of premise. But, you know, if you're there for just action, blood, and a lot of really cool sort of like fight choreography, it's going to be very entertaining. If you're looking for anything else,
such as a plot or character development.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Character development. As she said, it's a very simple plot. They need to get this quote unquote package, this guy who has very important information. They have to get him from the U.S. Embassy to an airstrip. And once he gets to the airstrip, he says he'll give them all this big, important secret information. But the one big asset this film does have is Iko Uwais, who is a big Indonesian actor, fight choreographer, and a martial artist. And he has a fight sequence.
Yeah, in the hospital.
Yes, he's handcuffed to a hospital bed. And for Jackie Chan fans, it's like a very brutal Jackie Chan.
Yeah, if you're a fan of that type of like fight choreography. Also with Iko, the other thing too is he was the star of The Raid and The Raid 2.
Yes.
Which Peter Berg pretty much admitted that that's why he wanted him to be a part of this movie. I feel like whatever he was paid, he should be paid more. Mark Wahlberg just shows up, points a gun and says, you know, Mark Wahlberg things, and he's top bill. But this guy is literally bleeding to death on screen to make this performance happen. And it's so great to watch in that. If you could just cut down his fight scenes, I'm there for the movie. Like, it's great.
Yeah, you know, and speaking of Wahlberg, don't you feel like the pitch was it's Jason Bourne with ADD?
Yeah.
No, because that is part of Wahlberg's character.
Really
fast. But he's hyperactive. He even has to wear a rubber band on his wrist. And when he thinks his mind is racing too fast, he has to snap it.
Yeah.
But also, you know, for an action film, I thought it was incredibly violent.
Yes, it's definitely a R-rated, hard R. Don't feel like you. This
it felt
is one
like
for
a video
kids.
Game. Watching yes. it, watching the trailer, it felt like watching
the
a
body
video
count.
Game.
There are more dead bodies than the miles.
Yeah, that's yeah. true. Yeah. Very right. true.
All right, that's mile 22 and 22,000 dead bodies. Okay, moving on. Alpha, this is an origin tale of how dogs became our best friend. Here's a clip.
My father always told me, survival is never certain. And when there are no more leaders to follow, you must become one.
Okay, Mark, what is the story here?
Well, it is boy meets wolf.
Yeah, boy meets wolf dog.
Yes, and you know what? I have to say, I like any film that opens with the graphic, Europe, 20,000 years ago. So it might be my favorite movie that ever opened with Europe, 20,000 years ago. But did it make you laugh when about after a quick 10-minute scene, they then put up the next graphic, 1 week earlier.
Yeah.
No, and I thought, did they have weeks back yeah. then?
And that was the thing. In that promo, they had him speaking English. By the way, the film yes. has no English within it. Obviously, they're speaking this sort of whatever Anglo-Saxon derivative that yes. they were speaking at that time in Europe. I have no idea, obviously.
Yeah. And we don't even know where in Europe.
No,
just
we have no.
Europe.
It
just
looked cold.
Europe. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, it looked very cold.
There were no Starbucks.
I mean, it's a prehistoric tale, basically.
Yes.
And it's basically, again, the inception of how dogs became domesticated. And I'm not going to lie to you. I went into this film. I'm a dog owner. And I was like, this is just for people who are a little too much love their dogs. But it's actually a lot better than I thought. It's Albert Hughes' first film that he's doing by himself. It's not the Hughes brothers. Mm-hmm. It's just him doing this. And it's actually, I think, you know, an entertaining sort of, you know, hour and a half.
Is it sweet, do you think?
Yes.
Aww.
Yeah, I agree. I thought Albert Hughes did a very good job with yeah. the direction because it is gorgeous to yeah. look at. Now, I saw this in 3D IMAX, and yep. that certainly helped.
And I think that's the way it's intended to be seen. It's one of those films where I also thought it wasn't going to be that great because it rested on the shelf for over a year. Mm. I mean, Sony originally, I think we're going to have this fall of 2017, and then they eventually put it out now. I think it's enjoyable. The last time I checked, it was still fresh on our tomato meter as well, so critics are not completely railing against it. I had more fun with it than Mile 22, I'll go ahead and say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not saying a lot.
I know.
No.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think the boy and the wolf walked over 22 miles.
They definitely yeah. walked way more
22,000 years ago.
But the 3D IMAX stuff was impressive. It yeah. felt at times like the upper Paleolithic era was just jumping right out at
yeah.
you.
And the CGI dog, like you did not at any point feel like you were looking at CGI animals.
That's very true.
Yeah.
In fact, they're getting so much better with CGI yeah. that, like, they have that vista shot of a herd of woolly mammoths, yeah. and it is so impressive.
Yeah.
It doesn't look fake at all. So it really is. It's gorgeous to look at, and I agree with Jacqueline. It was so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Okay, sticking with the animal theme, a coming-of-age drama called We the Animals. It's about three brothers growing up in an unstable household based on the novel of the same name.
I need you to be good and quiet around your mom.
It's my birthday tomorrow.
Happy birthday, old man.
Do you think Pops will ever come back?
He always comes back.
God, starving.
Come ring.
Hello?
Mommy, how come you didn't answer the phone when I call you?
Because you sound so ugly. Hello?
Hello?
What are we gonna do?
Okay, Jacqueline, this was a darling at Sundance, I understand.
Yeah, and that's when I first saw it. And it's kind of great because you're basically telling a POC sort of coming of age story. Although, again, it is one of those ones where you're definitely dealing with a lot of trauma, a lot of pain. And it's also, I've talked to a lot of my LGBTQIA friends. It's a great one that kind of harkens back to Moonlight, where you're talking about identity and finding yourself in sort of, again, as you said, unstable circumstances. Mm. Very well done, films.
So one of the kids is gay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
is that a spoiler?
I mean, no, it's a book.
And
it's
actually,
been out.
And
yeah.
actually, I thought that was something the film did very well of just he keeps a journal, but like full of drawings. He's this imaginative, sensitive kid. He's very different from his brothers. And he's just trying to figure it all out.
Yeah.
And I thought that's what it really captured. Yeah. Well, I found this to be a very well done, engrossing film. And the lead kid, his name is Evan Rosado. And his performance is so natural and so real. I think it almost rivals that of Brooklyn Prince, the young girl from Florida Project last year. I was blown away by his performance. I think it's very well acted. And another nice thing they did is his drawings in the book, at certain points, they come alive. And so there's some animation in it.
Yeah.
And it reminded me in a good way of how they used animation in Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yes, that's very true. That's exactly the way it felt like.
And it did feel naturalistic looking at the trailer, almost like a documentary.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, you feel like it harkens back to Beasts of a Southern Wild for me in a lot of ways in that sort of respect. But that's the other thing. If I had one quibble with it, I'm so happy that we got to see this coming of age story with POC characters. I just would like to see one where there's nothing attached to pain. You know, it's kind of a narrative at this point that I'm like, I've seen it a lot. Even when it's great and well done like this, I would just like to see, you know, some happier. Can we get the eighth grade with some POC characters?
Yeah.
Can we get the Clueless with some POC characters? Just fun. And we have a film later on in this countdown where I think we're going to get a little bit of that.
I think we're going to get to it right now. It's called Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes.
Okay. It stars Constance Wu and Henry Golding.
I want the money.
1.2 million.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
That's what I'm... Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich. They're crazy rich.
Now, you really should have told me that you're like the Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
Okay, Jacqueline, you saw this one. This is getting tons and tons of buzz because it's a mostly Asian and Asian American cast. Does it live up to the hype?
It definitely lives up to the hype. I mean, first time in 25 years, you get an all Asian American cast by a major studio film. It's going to go out to 3,000 screens. It's already out now, came out on Wednesday, and it is brilliant. It is Pretty Woman meets basically any sort of coming of age, find your love sort of
Pride and Prejudice, yes.
Right. Cinderella, find your happy ending, and it's an unapologetic rom-com. It is not ironic. It is sweet. It is heartwarming. And you just want to fall in love with all the characters.
Well, they do say every comedy should end in a wedding. And I'm guessing that is the ending.
I mean, not the ending, but it's close. It's so close. So this is the story of Rachel. She has been dating a guy for a year and he comes from Singapore. They're heading back to Singapore to go to a wedding. And what she doesn't realize is she's basically dating Prince Charming. She doesn't realize he's the most prominent family in Singapore and ridiculously rich. There is so much luxury porn in this film. I mean, if you ever want to see how that 1% lives, this is the film to sort of live vicariously through it. And it's brilliantly done.
Mm, okay. And funny?
Funny. Awkwafina steals the show. It also has Constance Wu, as you mentioned, Henry Golding, and directed by John M. Chu, who has been very honest about how they wanted this film, him and Kevin Kwan, the author, wanted it to go to theaters because they felt it was important to Asian Americans to see this representation on screen, loud and proud. They almost went to Netflix, but they kind of turned down the big paycheck from Netflix to make sure that this could have this moment that it's having. And I think it's a really amazing film. So many people should see it.
Okay. Speaking of Netflix, our final film is on Netflix. It's called To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
I write a letter when I have a crush so intense that I don't know what else to do. There are five total. Peter with the beautiful eyes, Kenny from camp, Lucas from homecoming, John Ambrose from Model UN, and Josh, the boy next door.
Oh! Hey!
What are you doing?
Nothing.
Nobody else knows about them.
Okay, so Mark, those letters are going to get out.
Yes.
Those boys are going to know about those letters.
Yes. Her devious but well-meaning little sister.
You knew that it was going to be the little sister the minute you see
it. I mean, that's what I have to say is, obviously, this film is very predictable.
Yeah.
You're not going to get like, oh, I can't believe that plot twist. But it is so well done and very, very entertaining. I mean, it's as light as a cream puff, but just as sweet.
Yeah.
And the lead performance by Lana Condor. Some might remember her as Jubilee in X-Men Apocalypse. She gives such a charismatic,
authentic,
winning performance. that she really makes the film.
Yeah, I think between her and the relationship between her and John Corbett from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, I mean, that daddy-daughter dynamic and then the two young gentlemen that play her sort of like love interest, she gets caught in between because it's, again, she writes letters to these boys that she's fallen in love with, and there's two that are currently very close to her life. Her sister's ex-boyfriend and then the most popular boy in school, Peter and Josh, and she's sort of throughout the course of the film kind of going between which one she wants to be with more, maybe not, maybe faking a relationship. There's a lot going on in it. But yeah.
How would you compare it to Eighth Grade, which treads on similar territory?
I mean, Eighth Grade has the awkward factor that this one doesn't. There's a little bit of awkward, but not as much.
And it's a big difference to be in Eighth Grade and be a junior in high school.
Yeah, this
so is, she's 16. The lead girl is 16. And that's what it really does capture is you're at that age where you're a teenager and you're expected to be dating, and it's kind of, and once she's in high school and trying to deal with all the, you know, problems and rivalries and everything, it's like a softer Mean Girls meets, and we're going back here, 1987's Can't Buy Me Love, a Patrick Dempsey film.
That is a little Can't Buy Me Love.
That's going back to your youth.
Yes. I think some people just swerve their car from hearing that memory. But, you know, the plot is very similar to that, but as we said, the lead performance by Lana Condor is just so engaging. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and also our last three films, they're all based off of books. When you have great source material, you're able to adapt it a lot of times, if they do it right, to a great screenplay. And I think all of these three kind of show that. So it's great.
Yes.
All right. So some winners.
Yeah.
And Mile 22.
Which is supposed to be a franchise, by the way. So look forward to Mile 23.
24.
And then the next one, they 25. Go another mile.
Mark Jordan Lagan, TV writer and film historian. Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now with listener feedback at the end of the week.
Yes, well, it being a Friday in August, we talked about Rosé earlier on the show.
Got some time to fill.
So I reached out to listeners to see if they're into Rosé. And Bitchcoin, which is just a great Twitter handle, I have to say, wrote, "I think people are becoming less snobbish about Rosé," which I think is true, right? I mean, it's sort of had this reputation of being like not what the connoisseurs of wine
like a girly
would drink.
Drink.
Oh, what? Exactly. But not so much anymore. Lee says if it's from Sussex or Kent, which is funny. You know, Southern England now does have this wine industry. Like there are a bunch of wineries down there, and you would never think of Southern England as being a source of wine.
So with climate change, it'll soon be Provence.
Right. Well, you've been known to drink a little rosé, right, Madeline?
Yeah. I have been known to do that.
You have? Do you ask for, what did you call it, a grower rosé?
No, but now I will.
I just
grab the stuff off Trader Joe's. It's
funny you should say that. Steve LaRue tweeted me a picture of a bottle of rosé called Panetti that he gets from Ralph's. Turns out our listeners
that
are actually...
That fine sommelier,
exactly,
Ralph.
Yeah. Turns out our listeners are actually pretty into rosé. 39% of them say all day, rosé, yes. 33% of them say, it's okay. So that's fully what? 72% that say that are either really into it or kind of into it.
Are you a tippler yourself?
I like rosé, yeah.
Okay.
I have a little rosé. 15% say they don't touch the stuff. 13% don't drink alcohol. So there you go.
All right. Well, have a great weekend with or
you
without
too.
Rosé.
Okay.
All right. That's it for Press Play. Our producers this week are Christian Bordahl, Amy Ta, Michelle Aloy, Yael, Evan Orr, Devin Brown. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. We had some engineering help from Bill Richards this week. I'm Madeline Brand. See you Monday.